Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here. And from
New Hampshire Center for Cognitive and Behavioral Therapies, providing outpatient, evidence-based, specialty behavioral health and substance use disorder services. NHCCBT.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange. A special New Hampshire House election in a district dominated by Republicans is won by a Democrat. At least one Democrat has opted out of taking on Republican Governor Chris Sununu in the 2018 gubernatorial election. And as Puerto Rico struggles in the wake of Hurricane Maria, New Hampshire rallies to do its part to help. These and other stories made headlines this week, and we'll talk about them this hour. And we'd like you to lend your voice to this conversation. What about this week's news do you want to know? What perspective can you share that will help your fellow listeners understand the story? You can call into the Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org. or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word. And here to talk about the week's news and answer your questions are Dean Spiliotis, civics scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU and author of the website NH Political Capital, Kevin Landrigan of the Union Leader, and Paul Steinhauser, political reporter here in New Hampshire. And we're going to start the show by talking about the special election in Rockingham County. And again, the phone number for you to lend your voice to this conversation is 1-800-892-6477. All right, so let's get started here. Democratic candidate Carrie Lerner of Chester defeated Republican James Head of Auburn Tuesday in a special House election in Rockingham County. It was a surprising victory. The district has 20% more registered Republicans than Democrats, and this is the third time a Democrat has flipped a seat in a Republican stronghold since May. So, Dean, what do you think of this?
Yeah, it was certainly an interesting result, a little bit of a surprise for some people. I was listening to some statistics the other day that there have been something like 49 of these special elections nationwide around the country. Democrats have flipped 8 of the seats. GOP has flipped 1 of the seats. So if you're looking at these local elections as some sort of early sign of what might happen in 2018 or even 2020, that's encouraging for Democrats. You know, this is a House seat and a state House seat, and to some extent, those elections are always local. But this is a district that Trump carried by 23 points, and it's certainly something that Democrats can you know perhaps take a little bit of hope in. You know, it's you know the Republican Party has a sort of internal factions right now. It's always easier when you're in the opposition to be unified behind a candidate. This is a very close race. It's something like 39 seats, 39 votes. This can probably be a recount. I'm always hesitant to kind of read too much into one seat. But if you're keeping score, Democrats are ahead in the flipping seats category around the country so far.
It's really energizing Democrats. You look after this victory, there were statements from the state party all the way up to the Democratic National Committee putting statements out.
Social media is facilitating that. It goes national immediately when there's a local flip like that.
So Democrats are saying, hey, you know, listen, we've got the energy. We've got the momentum. This is a referendum, even on maybe on Chris Sununu, maybe even on Donald Trump. Here's the real story, though. Candidates do matter. Carrie Lerner was a good candidate. She's well known in the district. It is a heavily Republican district. This is, you know, Sandown and Chester we're talking about, but she's a realtor. She's well known there. Candidates do matter. I'm not saying the Republican candidate wasn't a good candidate. James Head was a former state rep, so he is well known. Here's what Republicans are saying. They're saying this is less of a referendum on Sununu, less of a referendum on Trump. We basically got outmaneuvered. The Democratic Party machine in the state is larger. They've got more workers, and we weren't able to really generate get out the vote efforts until the last minute. And they basically were saying we were outmanned.
And St. Anselm political science professor Christelle Galdieri told NHPR earlier this week that Democrats in the state are using President Donald Trump to rally support for their party.
Donald Trump has activated Democrats in a way that I don't think any other president would have. I don't think if you had John Kasich or Jeb Bush or Marco Rubio in the White House, I don't think you would have seen the same sort of outpouring of opposition and activism.
So, Kevin Landrigan of the Union Leader, does that make sense to you?
Yeah, to some degree, Chris is right. But it's true, Paul's accurate in terms of these local elections are about local issues. Trump was not on this ballot, and he wasn't talked a lot about by Kerry Lerner or by James Head, for that matter. The concern for Republicans really is this: the Democratic machine has a lot of energy behind it. We're seeing it in the Manchester mayoral race as well, where Joyce Craig won the preliminary election. First time a woman has won a primary election in Manchester for mayor. That's where the Democratic activism is. More than $300,000 is raised for her by Democrats from across the country. That's what Republicans have to worry about, and they hope to turn it around by the midterms in 2018.
Mm-hmm. So is this an indicator of how things will go in 2018, or is it really too soon to tell?
Paul? It's too soon to tell. I tell you, we always take a look at these special elections, congressional ones, state house ones. We still have a long way to go until November 2018.
Yeah, you know, I will say one thing. You know, typically midterm elections like the one coming up in 2018 are not good for the majority party. You look at 2010, 2014 were both bad for Democrats. You had a Democratic president. You go back to 2006, a big Democratic year, a bad year for George W. Bush. So all things being equal, you would expect that the opposition party, the Democrats in this case, would have more energy, would be able to pump up turnout. But we'll see. It is still a little bit early. But I think in part because of the social media echo chamber, these kinds of sort of micro level results just percolate up to the national surface almost immediately now.
Yeah, always beware of the social media echo chamber. So while we're talking about elections, let's talk about the coming gubernatorial race that, you know, there's going to be an election for that in 2018. Executive Councilor Democrat Andrew Walensky has decided he will not run for governor in 2018. Here's what he had to say.
Well, it just isn't the right time for me on a personal, professional, experiential level. I'm doing well as counselor. I enjoy the job. I think I'm making a difference. And I think pursuing that is in everyone's best interests.
So Andrew Walensky says he wants to keep doing what he's doing as an executive counselor. Paul, your thoughts on his sort of opting out for the 2018 race?
I understand. Yeah, it makes sense. It does make sense. I got to say, though, he was really talking like a gubernatorial candidate and sounding like one. I covered him over Labor Day at a rally where he was with Bernie Sanders, and he was taking a lot of shots at Governor Sununu. He's been one of Sununu's most vocal critics on the council and in Concord this year. So I was a little surprised, but I get it. Andrew Walensky's got a long political career ahead of him if he wants it. He was just elected last year for the first time. That was his first run for office. I think what Democrats won't say, though, is that they're a little nervous. They're a little nervous about beating Chris Sununu next year. We talked about this national tie that will help Democrats, and that's very true. But also remember, only one governor in this state in the last 90 years has lost re-election to a second two-year term. Those honors go to Craig Benson back in 2004. It's hard for a governor in this state to lose a second two-year term. And Sununu's doing well right now. We got a long way to go, but right now he's doing well. He got a lot of what he wanted out of the legislative session. His approval numbers are good. He's going to be a tough person to beat in 2018.
Kevin, you're nodding at what Paul's saying about Sununu's strength and perhaps his strength being a sort of deterrent for Democrats to join the primary.
Yeah, it's really hard for folks who try to get traction in a second term against a governor with a two-year term. The bad news is you're running all the time. The good news is you have less baggage than someone who has a four-year term and has to put that up before the voters. So that's one of the reasons why historically, first-term governors win re-elections. And with a Republican legislature that was very good to this governor, that gave this governor full-day kindergarten, that gave this governor a budget essentially that he wanted, that gave this governor concealed carry repeal, which is a big social conservative issue that that really helps buttress Sununu's support among conservatives who may not be happy about some of the issues he takes with regard to spending.
Okay, so Walensky's not running. Who is running, right?
Right.
Democratic side, right? That's the question. Marchand's already in. Steve Marchand. Remember, he ran last time around.
And he praised Walensky.
He did praise Walensky. Yes, he did. Smart move. He came in a surprise second last time around. This is the former Portsmouth mayor last time around, 2016. He's in. He announced in early April. That's one of the earliest times we've ever seen a governor in this state or a gubernatorial candidate announce. Who else, though? I did an article for the Monitor this week about that, and they're not. There doesn't seem to be a lot of people right now. Let's go through some of the names. Mark Connolly, who ran last time, as well. I wouldn't count on Connolly running. I don't think it's likely. A lot of Democrats would love to see Chris Pappas run on the executive council. I don't see that either. Yeah. Dan Feltes, another young and up-and-coming Democrat like Pappas. He just had a newborn child. I don't see him running.
Paul, was this the article that had the headline "Rumors Swirl Among Democratic Candidates in the in the governor's race"? Because I read that article, and you know, the article basically says that, you know, other than Marchand, there's really not anybody at the moment who seems to be chomping at the bit to get in. And I think it's because Sununu's popular. He's a first-term governor. It's very difficult to unseat a first-term governor. You know, maybe at the midterm there'll be enough Democratic energy to sweep him out. But it's going to be a tall order given the electoral history of governors in New Hampshire. But it's interesting because I read that article looking for sort of some new angle, and basically it kind of confirmed what a lot of people think, and that there's people aren't lining up at the moment to run for governor.
Keep your eyes on Gary Hirschberg, though. Okay, he's the former
possibly, but we've mentioned him every two years for the last 10 years.
Yeah, but here's what's telling about it this time around. You guess where he was on Monday night at a Democratic State House of Representatives gathering. He's been involved in national politics for a long time, but now he's doing more state stuff. He's going to be headlining a Carroll County Democratic dinner in October. These are things he hasn't done before. Keep your eyes on him. He's got money, obviously. He could self-fund.
And what about Colin Van Ostern?
Don't rule him out. Rule him out.
Yeah, I think certainly he's somebody who can step into the race and be instantly a front runner for the primary that he won convincingly in 2016. He could do it again. That's why he's got this luxury of sitting back and waiting as long as he cares to, frankly.
But he's also a very experienced political professional, and he will very carefully read the geography of the race before. That's why right now in the article he's sort of non-committal and sort of.
He's also non-committal because you don't get to run. Right. You don't get to run over and over again anymore.
Right.
In
at some point you lose your political capital.
At some point you're gone.
You keep losing. Yeah. Right.
He can't lose again.
Dean, I'm glad you read the article. Thank you very much.
It was an excellent article. My issue was with the headline writer, not with the article. The article I think was right on, but the headline suggested that there's all this sort of swirling discussion over who's going to run, and they're just. You know,
let's be honest,
right now,
headlines,
it's just
Steve headlines are a tease.
Yep.
Headlines certainly tough to write. Okay, this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR, where we are dissecting those very headlines that Dean is calling into question. I'm Peter Biello, and we're going to be talking about tax reform. We're going to be talking about 2020, because why not? We're going to be talking about checkpoints on I-93 and also the Millennial Council that Governor Sununu convened this week. If you are a millennial and you have an issue that those folks on the council should be talking about with the governor, give us a call. Let us know what those are. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Also, if you've got insights into this tax reform thing we're going to talk about, also 2020 preview or, you know, the New Hampshire primary. Apparently, California is thinking of moving its primary up to Super Tuesday, 3 months ahead of time. Big Democratic state. What implications might that have for New Hampshire's first-in-the-nation primary? We're going to be talking about that, so please give us a call now, 1-800-892-6477. All right, so tax reform. The Graham-Cassidy bill that would have repealed and replaced the Affordable Care Act did not have enough support to move forward, so Republicans are now looking toward an overhaul of the tax code. So, Dean, we'll start with you on this. This is a complex proposal that we've seen from the administration. It's going to change, but at this point, in brief, if it's possible to do it in brief, what does this tax reform propose?
Sure, and just to get to your initial point, as now retiring Senator Bob Corker said, tax reform is going to make healthcare seem easy in comparison. Well, this particular plan, if it were passed as proposed, as far as we know, would lower the corporate tax rate from 35% to 20%. There seems to be some bipartisan agreement on the need to do that. It's going to move the top individual bracket from 39 8.5% down to 35%. The bottom individual bracket's going to go from 10% up to 12%, but there are other sweeteners in the bill that would sort of balance that out. The suggestion from the administration is that if you make a $55,000 income, you get about a $650 to $1,000 tax cut. It's also going to eliminate the estate tax, and that's always a controversial proposal. So it's still kind of in its formative stages, as usual with these kinds of proposals. When you listen to what's coming out of Capitol Hill, it kind of means different things to different people. But it's going to be a long haul, and it's going to end up being a debate over whether or not this will really benefit the middle class. Republicans say yes, Democrats say no. It's really focused mainly on upper income.
And Kevin, how are local Republicans responding to this?
Local Republicans like it a lot. I think, you know, New Hampshire doesn't have an income tax, so this proposal is very appealing to them. Governor Chris Sununu has indicated it's a plan that works for New Hampshire because it rewards work. It preserves retirement security. It doesn't change Social Security in any manifest way, and also would end the shipping of jobs and capital overseas, which has been a big issue for New Hampshire. Certainly, we saw during the 1990s more exports, more jobs from New Hampshire, economic activity go to China and other countries more in New Hampshire than any other state in the country. So that's a big point that Republicans want to change about this proposal, and it would. Mm-hmm. But as Dean points out, you know, there's a lot of commas to fill in here. We talk about the lowest tax rate going down to 10% and the highest tax rate going down to 35%. But the bill, the outline doesn't tell you what the numbers are. In other words, it doesn't even tell you where that in, what's the lowest income tax bracket? What's it end at? It doesn't say. So that's one reason why even on NPR this week, there were analysts all over the country saying, this could increase taxes on the middle class. This could lower taxes on the middle class. We don't really know by what we're looking at right now.
Early days, of course. Paul.
You know, Trump administration originally said they were going to have tax bill done and signed into law by August. That obviously didn't happen. Now they're saying they moved the goalposts now to the end of the year. That's very, very unlikely. Remember, we haven't had major federal tax reform since Ronald Reagan was in the White House. Why? It's hard to do.
Very hard to do. And it's safe to say that our all-Democratic congressional delegation not happy with this proposal?
Well, I do think – I think the Democratic talking points are to be, as Dean was pointing out, to be accommodating on tax reform, to be open on tax reform. But there are two things they won't tolerate that Republicans are determined to deliver. One is a tax cut for the wealthy. The Republican base wants this. They want this high tax rate lowered. That's it's not a non-starter for Democrats. But the second part is that they don't want this plan to blow the deficit. And Vice President Mike Pence this week acknowledged it's going to cost at least $1.5 trillion. And he says economic activity is more than going to make up for that. Democrats will oppose any plan that does that.
You're listening to the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. So with respect to this tax proposal, it seems like there's going to be a lot of negotiation. Is President Trump sort of starting at an extreme, hoping to perhaps meet somewhere closer to the middle, Paul?
Yeah, originally he wanted corporate tax rate down to 15%. So I think that was kind of an initial point in negotiations. Donald Trump likes to say he's a great negotiator. Well, he needs to get involved in this one, though. But Kevin made a good point. And some conservatives have a problem with this. This tax cut isn't paid for. And a lot of fiscal conservatives, and there still are some in Washington, are going to have an issue with that. Even in this state, I was talking to Jeff Chittister, who is a pretty conservative guy and a fiscal conservative. And that was one of the things he likes to tax plan overall. But he said it doesn't pay for itself. It's going to make the deficit even bigger. That's an issue.
Dean, you're nodding.
Yeah, there's just a fundamental disagreement as far back as I can remember, you know, certainly back to the discussion during the Reagan administration about whether or not cutting top marginal tax rates increases investment or just gives wealthy individuals more money to save. And that's I heard that all over cable television last night discussing this. You had Democrats on who say this isn't going to do anything for economic growth, and Republicans who say you bring down that top tax bracket. You get rid of the estate tax. That's going to be more money for investment. It's just a fundamental supply side argument that we've heard for many years. But again, the debate always is going to come down to whether or not this is good for the middle class.
Voodoo economics, does that ring a bell?
Sure.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. Give us a call with your thoughts on tax reform or 2020, which is what we're going to be talking about next. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. You can also send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Okay, so it's 2017, but, you know, we're going to talk about 2020, because why not, right?
It's fun.
So, and Paul, you've been writing about this week. I mean, Martin O'Malley is going to be here in New Hampshire. He ran in the Democratic primary in 2015-2016, ostensibly campaigning for some local candidates, but perhaps got 2020 on his mind?
Oh, yeah. This was his third trip here to New Hampshire this year alone, which you'd think is a lot, but guess what? Jason Kander, the former Missouri Secretary of State's been here 5 times already. So this is a story that's really not on the national radar yet, but thanks to being the first in a nation primary state, we're getting these visits. I bumped into O'Malley where else? At the Puritan Back Room, which if you're running for the White House, that's a must stop. He was in New Hampshire to campaign for Joyce Craig in Manchester to headline a big Salem Democratic Party dinner and to talk to Hassan Essa.
Yeah, and we have some tape of him. So let's hear what he had to say.
Look, when I'm asked whether I would run again, I say I just might. I very well might. But right now, what I've decided is that I'm going to put my energies into helping people that are running in these midterms. In other words, I've made an affirmative decision not to make that decision right now. And instead, what I'm going to do is what I think all of us want to do right now, which is the next good thing for our country. And for my part, that next good thing is to help other people who are running for governor, running for state senate, running for state houses, to win back their own state so that we can win back our country.
Okay, so what I heard in that, maybe Dean, Paul, Kevin, you can weigh in, and that is that sure. I'm going to help people win in 2018. So if they do win, they can help me in 2020.
A bingo, and that's what they'll never say. But that's the game. That's the sure. well traveled game plan. That's the strategy here. They'll never admit they're running in the next presidential, but they're here to make friends, and hopefully those friends will help pay them back when it comes to time to run. There is one exception. A guy that almost nobody knows, a guy called Congressman John Delaney of Maryland, Democrat, 3 terms. He's coming up again this weekend, and guess what? He actually has said I'm running. He's the only one, though. He's actually flat out said I'm not running for re-election in Congress. I'm running for president. God bless him.
Yeah, and he's someone who will have a lot of heavy lifting to do in terms of name recognition up here, but uh-huh. He is up here. Governor O'Malley is someone who's been mentioned as a potential presidential nominee going all the way back at least to 2012 and even earlier. He was up here a lot in 2016, spent a tremendous amount of time engaged in retail politics. I interviewed him a number of times. I'm sure Paul did as well and Kevin. And mm-hmm. He did not get a tremendous amount of traction. So, you know, maybe things will be different this time. Sometimes spending a lot of time here is helpful if you're able to get the right kind of traction. Other times it can be very frustrating if you put in tremendous amount of legwork and don't have much to show for it. So, you know, I'm certainly reserving judgment on him, but it does seem like he's gearing up to run again.
What about Republicans? Are Republicans coming to New Hampshire anticipating perhaps a challenge to the president?
John Kasich's the only one who's been here so far. He came up here back in April for his book tour. No other Republican who we think may possibly primary challenge the president has been here yet, but that could change over the next year.
Okay. Well, this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup, and we're speaking with Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, Kevin Landrigan of the Union Leader, and political reporter Paul Steinhauser. If you have questions about the week's news, something the press didn't catch, perhaps, that we should be talking about, let us know. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Still to come, we'll be talking about immigration, the Millennial Council that the governor has convened, voter checklists, and a miscommunication that we believe has been corrected. We'll dissect that. And of course, Amazon, it's not staying out of the news, so we'll talk about it again. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Peter Biello, and we will be right back.
Help pay for high-quality journalism in New Hampshire by becoming a new NHPR sustaining member at just $10 a month. As our thanks, we'll send you a special thank-you gift, an NHPR mug, and a pair of NHPR socks that both feature the majestic purple finch. Setting up your sustaining gift is quick and easy to do at nhpr.org. And thanks.
The weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, here in the studio with Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, Kevin Landrigan of the Union Leader, and Paul Steinhauser of NH1 News and a political reporter. It's been a busy week for reporters in New Hampshire, and now is your chance to get some answers to your questions about what's been happening in the Granite State. Though we are going to look to the Golden State of California in just a moment because they are moving their primary from June to March. We'll talk about the implications of that. To join the discussion, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email nhpr.org. All right, so the primary news of the week is mostly based in California because they're moving theirs to Super Tuesday in March with a bunch of other states instead of June. Dean, how does this change things for Democrats?
It's interesting. It was signed by Governor Jerry Brown, who was a candidate for president here in 1992. So it comes full circle. Lost the nomination to Bill Clinton, obviously, who went on to become president. Yes, California has decided to move up to March 3rd. It's the sixth time since 1992 that California has moved its primary. Right. They've been in March, they've been in February, they've been in June. They've been all over that roughly 6 month period for primaries and caucuses. They think that it'll make them more relevant. You know, the schedule is not finalized yet, but you know that those early March Tuesdays, typically you get a number of states stacking up right behind the sort of pre-primary caucus window where you have, you know, Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, and South Carolina. They're not threatening to jump any of those four slots, but you get this front-loading phenomenon where everybody starts to bunch up right up against the window, and maybe some people will even eventually challenge New Hampshire's position. So we've seen this before. You know, California is a fundamentally different place when it comes to campaigning. Harder to do retail politics, very expensive to advertise, a lot of geography to cover, a lot of media markets. It's just fundamentally different than being here in New Hampshire.
Okay, but the premise behind this is, of course, you know, debating the importance of the relationship between relevance in the primary process and where it falls in the calendar. Like, is there a relationship that we can clearly articulate? Dean, Paul, Kevin, I don't know.
I mean, someone else can jump in, but my quick take on that is, you know, in theory it sounds good, but when you start to have 6, 8, 10 states all bunching up on the same early Tuesday in March, it kind of gets diluted a little bit, and we move closer to a national primary.
It'll be the Super Tuesday like I guess we've never seen before, but we've said that before. What is interesting is if this truly does happen, does it dilute at all the New Hampshire primary? Will a few visits by candidates who are going to come here, maybe they'll go to California instead? Didn't happen really 8 years ago when they did this, so I don't think we have a lot to worry about here. And I will say, shout out to our old friend Kathleen Ronayne, the AP reporter here in New Hampshire. She was reporting this because now she's with AP out in Sacramento, so it was a big story for her.
Yeah, comprehensive report by Kathleen.
What happened last time California did this. They've never succeeded at doing this. In 2008, they moved the primary up to February. 23 other states moved to the same date. So California was a non-entity. And that's precisely what could happen this time as well, as other states look and say, why should California be first? The other difference California did, Governor Moonbeam, Jerry Brown, did with this new bill, is it would move their state primary up to March. So because they didn't do that in 2008, and they ended up handing the taxpayers a big bill for a primary that only had a presidential beauty contest, because by the time they had their vote, it didn't matter. Now candidates in California are complaining about having to run an 8-month-long general election campaign, which, you know, in California is going to run into the hundreds of millions of dollars.
So let's move away from politics for now. Let's talk about immigration, because that was also in the news this week. U.S. Customs and Border Protection agents staged another immigration checkpoint on I-93 in the town of Woodstock, New Hampshire. It's about 75 miles from the international border. They held one in August as well. Dean, what happens at these stops? Why are they taking place?
Well, I mean, Border Patrol has done these kinds of checkpoints in the past. You know, it has been sort of complicated by the kind of current environment surrounding immigration and the, you know, challenges to tighten up the borders, et cetera. The one that they had in August, they detained, I think, 25 people under immigration issues, and another 30 were arrested for a variety of drug-related and other kinds of offenses. So, you know, it feeds into sort of the larger debate over the Trump administration's push to crack down on people who are here illegally and to increase deportations. Not only typically it had traditionally been people with, you know, crimes, felonies, et cetera, but now there are a number of stories around the country of people who don't necessarily fall into that category, either being deported or being set up for deportation.
Mm-hmm. And is there an indication that we were going to see more of these?
I don't know if it's necessarily going to be stepped up any further, but I think you will continue to see them periodically. And, you know, for a lot of this stuff, the legal remedy ends up being in the courts just to try to block deportation.
Mm-hmm. Also in immigration news this week, New Hampshire's undocumented Indonesian population taking legal action against President Trump's deportation crackdown. A judge on Tuesday agreed to halt ongoing deportations for 2 weeks while the case moves forward. Kevin, tell us about this story. Like, who are these Indonesians and what was their status here?
Yeah, many of these folks, there's about 70 of them in New Hampshire. Many of them got tourist visas in order to come here. But a number of them are Christians, minority Christians in a country in which there was a lot of persecution of Christians in Indonesia. But they were never able to get asylum. So many of them have gotten tourist visas, have got extended. What was really significant about this decision in U.S. District Court in Boston was that for some of these folks, their ticket to get out of the country was punched on Wednesday, and the decision came out on Tuesday. So I talked with a Summersworth man who cried with his parents once they got the news that there's been this stay of execution now, but that's exactly what it is. It's a stay against any action being taken by the government, but it doesn't mean this issue goes away. But attorneys for all of these folks feel they have a compelling case to tell about a number of them, so they're hopeful that ultimately they can win in court.
Mm-hmm. Because the argument that they made in court, right, was that this was not enough time for due process.
Exactly, that these folks essentially being rushed out of the country without the opportunity to present compelling reasons why they need to remain here, and they can't go back to a country where they may not be safe.
Okay. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and we've been speaking with our guest today about a variety of things. Later in the program, we're going to be talking about taking a knee. High school students in New Hampshire and Maine have been kneeling during the national anthem before their games. If you have insight into or questions about this story or something else in the week's news, give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post to our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. So the Secretary of State's office says miscommunication is to blame for a message that appeared to direct local officials to strike the names of some voters from checklists without notifying them first. The clerks and supervisors saw this message telling him it was okay to do this without notifying them. Republican state lawmaker David Bates, who is a local checklist supervisor in Windham, says he contacted the Secretary of State and Attorney General soon after he saw those instructions. Let's hear what he had to say.
That would have been serious if supervisors just started, you know, removing scores of people from the checklist. That would have been a real problem.
And so Deputy Secretary of State David Scanlon said miscommunication was to blame for a message that appeared on the statewide website. Here's what he had to say about that miscommunication.
Yeah, there are a number of groups that have filed lawsuits against the election laws, and you know, they file those against our office. So we're dealing with that. We're dealing with numerous right-to-know requests. We're trying to train election officials, and there's only so many of us that can go around. So you can understand how miscommunication can take place, and we just have to work harder at it, that's all.
Dean, what do you make of his response to this?
It's interesting. You know, this interstate cross-check program is something that's been championed by Chris Kobach, who we've talked about on the Roundup many times. He's the head of the co-chair and basically the head of the Voter Integrity Commission that was recently here in New Hampshire. He's a big fan of this. You know, the issue here is that, you know, by state law, you have to be notified first and you have to be given an opportunity to state your case for whatever reason. And that was not done here. So this is, you know, feeding into the larger narrative that we've discussed here about voter suppression and that some of this stuff is going to kind of be pushed unilaterally by conservatives, et cetera. So this, you know, the issue here is in the greater context in terms of fraud is being registered in multiple states is not illegal. You can't vote in multiple states, but, you know, most of us, you know, when we leave a state to move into a new state, we often don't get ourselves removed from the voter checklist. That stuff's supposed to be done kind of naturally over time by the town clerks. So this is just another sort of element of this broader debate over fraud versus suppression and the concern among some voters that this kind of stuff is going to be done unilaterally without following the proper procedure.
Even Bates, whose, you know, voice on the Republican side is pretty influential when it comes to these matters, even he said that, you know, the cross-check could be a valuable tool as long as it's used responsibly. And I'll also, let's give a shout-out here to Casey McDermott, once again, doing a great job when it comes to all things voting.
Yeah. And so the scary thing about this, I mean, the state says that no voters have been removed without their knowledge. I mean, but how would voters even know if they've been removed without being notified? I mean, they just show up at the polls and suddenly they're not there.
Well, that's what happened. If you're removed from your local town checklist and you're not told and you go to vote, you're not going to be there anymore.
Yeah. But what about the argument that, you know, they've got a lot to do? Like, they've got right-to-know requests to handle. They seem to not have enough hands on deck to handle things. Like, does that argument hold water with you guys?
No. You know, my sense is that, you know, that we've heard this argument before, that there aren't enough resources. You know, there have been complaints that the Secretary of State's office and other related institutions don't have the funds to do all of this stuff. But, you know, you still have to be careful about, you know, the potential to infringe on somebody's right to vote in their town.
And taking this back to the political context, we had the huge fight this year over SB3. We're going to see fights next year in the state house as well. There are already some bills that are being entertained that will, you know, on the Republican side, that could curtail when it comes to domicile of out-of-state college students. So this fight is not over with the SB3 becoming law.
I believe Governor Sununu just said that he's not going to be as focused on these voting rights issues this time or bills. Was that something that you
read my articles again? Yeah, I'd ask.
You're everywhere.
That because some Republicans.
Right. That's a great get there to know that.
Well, some and thank you. But some Republicans in the state house may introduce these kind of bills that will even further tighten the laws. Right now, the governor says no, that's not on my radar. I like SB3; it's working. Let's keep it where it is.
Yep.
Stay tuned. That fight continues.
No, it's an interesting way to position himself going into the next election.
Okay. Well, let's also talk about, I mean, this is a story that we sort of laughed a little bit about 2 weeks ago. We laughed a little less about it last week. And now I'm not sure we're laughing at all, right? Like, this is the story about Amazon, of course, which New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu and a group of state residents still making an earnest push to bring Amazon here. They're looking to put up a new headquarters somewhere in the country. Boston area includes southern New Hampshire. So, Paul, Kevin, is New Hampshire a serious contender here for Amazon? Kevin?
No, I don't think they are. But I commend Governor Sununu for making the effort to try and do it. Amazon has said they're looking for a population of more than 1 million people. Well, that's just about the entire state of New Hampshire. So that's kind of a non-starter here. They're looking for creating thousands and thousands of jobs. Well, New Hampshire has the fourth lowest unemployment rate in the country and also has an incredible labor shortage right now. That's why Amazon earlier this week announced a fulfillment center with 10,000 more jobs coming to suburban Cleveland, to a closed shopping mall in suburban Cleveland. Why? Because there's a lot of people that need jobs in suburban Cleveland. And also... Amazon is looking, what's Amazon want more, most? It's a delivery center and a system that's quick and not national, international. And New Hampshire doesn't have the infrastructure to deliver that.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. So, all right, so Paul, go ahead.
Yeah,
you had something to say about Amazon.
A little shout out here. Sununu making that news first in an interview with the Concord Monitor that, yeah, in fact, New Hampshire was going to be making that pitch. Here's another problem. You know, this state isn't allowed to give incentives. And that's going to be a big problem. It was a problem for his predecessor, Governor Maggie Hassan, when she was trying to court GE to come here. They ended up going from Connecticut, not to New Hampshire, but to Boston. The lack of incentives, the lack of being able to give a tax break to a company is an issue. We have a great, this is a great state, but it's going to be tough to fend off other states who can give those kind of breaks.
So is this simply, at this point, a high-profile way for Governor Sununu to demonstrate that he is, in fact, fulfilling a campaign promise, which is to attempt to bring lots of businesses to New Hampshire? Dean?
Sure. You know, and I think it's genuine. I think, you know, why not throw your hat in the ring? Everybody else is doing it as well. But again, I think as my colleagues have said, I think the issue is going to be the inability to provide the kind of tax incentives that they're going to want. You know, and just sort of the kind of geography of what they're looking for in terms of mass transit, population center, workforce. You know, but who knows? Maybe we'll be surprised. Maybe it'll go in sort of near Nashua with this, you know, potential new rail line that they're talking about putting in or something. We'll see. It's certainly, you know, worth trying, and it does kind of fit into this sort of narrative that that the governor is active trying to bring business here.
So let's say that New Hampshire does not get this HQ2 for Amazon. Certainly a high profile, I don't know if you would even call it a loss because the chances are pretty slim as is, but would this be a painful enough experience for New Hampshire lawmakers to say, hey, maybe we should make it possible for the state to offer some kind of tax incentive for businesses so that the next time a huge Amazon-like company comes around, we can offer this as a way to sweeten the deal? I mean, is this something that lawmakers may remember? Kevin?
No. It's not, because it goes against the ethos of New Hampshire, which is we're a low-tax state, we're a less regulation state, we're a business-friendly state, but we don't do handouts, and we don't have corporate welfare here, because it's just not the way things work here in New Hampshire, and I don't think it would be very popular, not only with elected officials, I don't think the voters would like it either.
Okay, one more business story to talk about before the break, and that's the fact that the State Liquor Commission on Wednesday reported record sales for its most recent year, nearly $700 million in sales. Dean, what does this mean for the state, this increase?
It means people are coming up here and vacationing and buying liquor, and, you know, that's always certainly a way to bring in revenue. We've got something like 80 outlets in the state, and they brought in almost $700 million in sales, and about $156 million went into our general fund, which can be used for all different kinds of things. A little over $3 million into that alcohol treatment fund that we've talked about before. For anybody who's interested, the top-selling outlet is the I-95 Hampton outlet. So people going out to the beach, I guess.
And if you've noticed, anybody who lives in this state has noticed over the last 4 or 5 years, they've done a good job building new ones and renovating old ones.
Popping up all over the place.
Yeah, and I think that it's paid off. And right now, one of the other big ones is the one in Portsmouth by the traffic circle there. And that one is now in the process of getting going to be rebuilt. So it's working, I guess.
This is a thing that people actually rely on, it seems. I can't tell just by the numbers whether it means people have had a good year or a bad year. Anyway, so this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. We've been speaking with our guests today about a variety of stories in the news. We'll talk about a big one coming up. We hope that you will want to be a part of it. It's about taking a knee. This is a super emotional issue for people, but there are rational arguments on either side and in the middle, so we hope that you will weigh in with yours. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477. We'll be speaking specifically about how high school students have been taking a knee, their perspectives, of course, on the national perspective. Give us a call with yours, 1-800-892-6477. If you'd rather not call, give us an email. The email address is exchange@nhpr.org, or you can post on our Facebook page. Please be civil, NHPR Exchange. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. We'll be right back. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello here in the studio with Kevin Landrigan of the Union Leader, Paul Steinhauser, political reporter in New Hampshire, and Dean Spiliotis, civics scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. Call us with your questions about the week's news. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. Again, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And we wanted to ask for your help on a show that we are putting together next week. On Tuesday, we'll be focusing on the Vietnam War regarding the recent Ken Burns documentary. And we'd love to hear from Vietnam War veterans. Listen, call in during the show or send us an email now about your experience in Vietnam. What do you remember from those days? The email address is exchange at nhpr.org. Looking forward to hearing from you. And again, that show on the Vietnam War is on Tuesday. All right. So back to the week's news. Nine members of the Trap Academy girls soccer team in Kittery, Maine, took a knee during the national anthem on Monday night. It's another protest, perhaps a gesture of solidarity of those with those protesting what they see as racial injustice in America. Kevin, what are the details of this story here?
Yeah, well, certainly Betty Stevens was one of the students who organized the protest and one of the only students of color at Trap Academy. And they obviously wanted to start a conversation about racial injustice. Former 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick really started this protest to draw attention to racial injustice. What they didn't expect was that it would turn into cyberbullying. And Betty's mom is very concerned about that, that on social media, her daughter was pilloried quite a bit about having taken that step. And I think it speaks to what the national – it's part of the national dialogue that's occurred. When you have the president of the United States referring to SOBs who are taking a knee during the national anthem as being unpatriotic, then you've opened the floodgates. You've invited all kinds of venomous discourse to occur on this issue, and that's what we've seen.
Yeah, and taking it to the national, keeping it to the national level, you know, it's pretty clear what President Trump is doing. He is energizing his base once again, maybe after some tough news on DACA, some tough news on health care that his base wasn't probably so happy with. This plays extremely well to that 25, 30, 35% of Americans, those who are truly behind him. It deflects from other things that are not going so well, and it wraps the president and his supporters in the flag. Remember, these protests aren't about the flag. They're not about the military. They're not about the country. They're about racial injustice. But he's framing it a different way. And, you know, politically, it works for him. But there are consequences to that, and we're seeing that in these stories playing out in Maine and even here in New Hampshire.
Yeah, and there's a long history of protest in professional sports, in international amateur sports like the Olympics. They're incredibly high profile platforms to do so. In this particular story, you know, professional athletes often have a big influence on high school athletes. I think Paul is right. You know, President Trump has kind of co-opted a debate over a pretty specific debate over the relationship between African Americans and law enforcement, social justice, if you will, and made it something about the military and the flag, which was not the original intention. And he's done that quite effectively and in a very polarizing way. I was very concerned this over the past weekend. I saw Secretary of the Treasury Mnuchin on defending President Trump's position on this, and his comment, which I thought was quite flip, was that these professional athletes can practice their First Amendment rights in their spare time, as though if you have an employment contract, you somehow your constitutional rights are suspended while you're at work. And it was just a very sort of odd thing to say. And this is all a very polarizing debate. We'll see where it goes in the future. It's sort of morphed into mean different things to different people. But the folks who are engaged in that protest believe in it very deeply, and I think a lot of that is wrapped up in your First Amendment rights for sure.
Okay, we're going to hear a lot more about this story in the weeks to come. So let's put a bookmark in this one, revisit it when it comes up again. But let's talk about commuter rail in Nashua, because this was a big deal this week. Nashua Mayor Jim Donches addressed the Board of Aldermen this week prior to a vote on taking steps to a commuter rail, a public-private partnership. Here's what Mayor Donches had to say.
As far as the city of Nashua goes, we do not need to invest any money in the track improvements. There is no ongoing subsidy required of the city. So there's really minimal cost and a lot to be gained by the plan.
So the board signed off on the initial steps. Kevin, give us some insight on this. How big is the need for something like this in Nashua and the town of Bedford?
Well, certainly there's been a lot of support in Nashua for commuter rail. The business community is very much for it, political leadership, sometimes in both parties, but not always. But conservative Republicans who feel commuter rail is a boondoggle and there's never been a commuter rail project that hasn't lost money for government, which is probably true. What's unique about this project is that it's privately paid for. The Boston Surface Railroad Company out of Rhode Island would pay for extending this commuter line, which would run from Worcester, Mass., up to Lowell, and then to Nashua and Bedford. Not a bunch of commuters going from Nashua to Worcester, Mass., on a daily basis. So what there are a lot of commuters from Nashua going to Boston. And what they'd have to do with this kind of extension would be to ride a train to Lowell and then hop a train from Lowell to Boston, which would be pretty inconvenient and I think not commercially very popular. But it's trying to continue the dialogue, and that's what Mayor Dantas is trying to do, is to try to continue to build public support and business support for the idea of expanding commuter rail.
Absolutely. Oh. Baby steps here. Baby steps, right? Get something that's already existing because it's cheap. But as Kevin said, wait a minute. Who's going to Worcester? I mean, Boston is what is needed. So
Providence at the other end.
Yeah, and Providence. Who's going to Providence? No, everybody. Boston is what is needed. That's why this plan is not ideal. But maybe if it's a step towards getting to Boston, Dantas and the other supporters in Nashua feel that it's a move in the right direction. But again, getting to Boston, a lot of opposition from our governor. He campaigned against that. A lot of opposition in the Republican-dominated state house. So.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think Kevin was right on. Conservatives do not like commuter rail. They believe, you know, there's almost a philosophical argument about, you know, Big Brother kind of forcing people out of their cars off the interstates and into these very inconvenient trains. That they lose a lot of money. They're heavily subsidized. It's interesting to me the difference between having a Democratic governor and a Republican governor, a Republican state legislature. The whole discussion of commuter rail, which was very high profile for a number of years, just kind of vanished. We're just not talking about it now.
It was a big issue in the 2016 campaign, but you know what? Sununu beat Van Ostrom by 18,000 votes. The Republicans kept the legislature, so that's why, for now at least, game over.
Huh. So I'm surprised to hear all three of you describe this option as inconvenient. I mean, as someone who's been in Boston traffic before, I've wished for a train. You know, like, so, I mean, why not take a train?
Right, but unfortunately, this train doesn't go to Boston. That's the problem.
Well, you can pick up a train in Lowell.
You can switch trains, and some people may end up doing that.
So the idea behind this, I guess, maybe is to make, is it, correct me if I'm wrong, is there some potential that Nashua could be seen as sort of a far-flung bedroom community for Boston, maybe encouraging development, better increase in real estate prices there, maybe?
Yeah, and always has been. I mean, back in the 1980s, this is how it started. It was a demonstration project, and it started going to Nashua during the Carter administration, actually late 1970s, when there was a Democratic governor in office, coincidentally enough, in New Hampshire, Hugh Gallon. It started as an experimental project. It had some interest. One thing that kind of takes some of the pressure off this drive for commuter rail is commuter bus. The commuter bus service, I mean, take a look at the lots in Concord. The lots in Nashua, in Londonderry, they're full. And there are tons of people taking the bus to Boston every day, and many of them describe it as kind of effortless. They can get a lot of work done while they're riding, and that's sort of providing that alternative to rail, since rail, as yet, does not exist.
Okay, well, it's not a done deal yet, as far as I understand, right? Several more hurdles to clear.
Not a done deal. And listen, this argument's going to come up again in the next gubernatorial race next year. So, get ready. It's coming back again.
Okay. So there's one more issue we got to talk about. Actually, a couple more here. One of them, I don't know what kind of story you would describe this as, guys. This is there was a report this week that a potted tree in the governor's office had been. You guys, some of you are smiling now. We could call this tree gate. Okay. So there was a potted tree in the governor's office that was blocking a portrait of Senator Jean Shaheen, who was, you know, first woman elected governor of New Hampshire, first woman ever, right, to be both governor and senator. What's the before we get into the answer of this, I should say that this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. Okay. So what is the origin of this story? Where did this story come from?
I first popped up for me on social media, on Twitter. Some Democrats, they took I recall who went into the office, but got a picture of this potted tree, which
was
supposedly
it
there.
Reardon, I think it might have been. Yeah, Judy
perhaps,
Reardon.
But it was supposed it was there temporarily, supposedly, but it was literally blocking. You know, you could kind of see a little bit of Senator Shaheen's clothing, sort of through the branches. And so, you know, Democrats raised a stink on social media, and it was, I think it's going to be moved, or has already perhaps been moved.
It's been moved. It's gone. Yeah. The governor put out a statement, which I don't have in front of me. I wish I did, explaining what happened. And it was there was a, I guess, a gift to the corner office, and that's where it was put.
It was the state tree, right?
It was the state tree, correct. Great. And that's where it was put. Maybe if I was working there, I would have not put it in front of the only female governor, or the first female governor in the state. But it's what happened. And listen, this is again, another example of social media at work. This is something that probably we wouldn't even be talking about if it wasn't for Facebook and Twitter.
Okay. But no evidence that this was politically motivated. Like, that would have been a huge petty move if it were.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. No, none at all.
So we can move on from this one, from Treegate, and talk about Puerto Rico, because this was something that actually was meaningful this week. The governor announced that there's going to be a big food drive next week in Concord to support those affected by Hurricane Maria. Kevin, you know the details on this.
Yeah, Tuesday and Wednesday, but from 7 a.m. to 6 p.m., people can come and donate to the hurricane relief drive in Puerto Rico. The governor and Homeland Security Commissioner Perry Plummer said it's important to go online, nh.gov or nhreadyaswell.gov, and find out what is really needed. These folks need specific things: bottled water, can openers. They need cash as well, fruit bars, protein bars. This drive really was started by the governor, who, interestingly enough, has developed really a relationship with Ricardo Rossello, who's the Puerto Rican governor. They came into office at the same time. They both graduated from MIT. They've gotten to know each other through the Governors Association events, and Sununu has wanted to see if he can do whatever the state can do. And as we saw with the telethon with Hurricane Harvey, I'm sure New Hampshire will step up big.
And this is the governor being very proactive, and especially at a time when the president himself has come under a lot of criticism from Democrats and even some from Republicans for not being active enough in responding to what happened in Puerto Rico.
Well, gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us. This has been the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. I want to thank you guys, Dean Spiliotis of SNHU, Kevin Landrigan of the Union Leader, and political reporter Paul Steinhauser. Thank you very much, guys.
Thanks, Peter.
Thanks.
Great to be here.
And remember, this conversation continues online on Facebook and at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.